Hello and welcome to AFAL Podcasts, the home of objective, up-to-date, independent reporting on Turkey. Don't forget to follow our reports through social media, on afalnews.com, or through our mobile app. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, AFAL editor David Lepesca, and with me today is Dimitar Becev, AFAL contributor and research fellow at the Atlantic Council. Hello, Dimitar, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
We are speaking on Wednesday, December 4th, just as a two-day gathering of NATO leaders in London is wrapping up. NATO's major gripe against Turkey is, of course, its purchase of Russian S-400 missile defenses, which started arriving in July. NATO and U.S. officials have said the S-400s could jeopardize NATO security. And also, the alliance itself was founded to defend against the Soviet threat and still today views Russia as the most destabilizing force in the region. So in buying the S-400s, Turkey appears to have committed a serious offense to the alliance. Would you agree with that? And how much is Putin enjoying all this bickering?
Well, he's having a ball, that's for sure, because Turkey is a major member of NATO, and having this rift between Turkey on the one hand and the U.S., but also the Western European allies, is the best he could hope for. And certainly the decision to purchase the S-400s and to set them in place kind of sends a very strong signal that Turkey is pursuing an autonomous foreign policy, which is music to the ears of the Kremlin.
In addition to the offense against NATO, Turkey's S-400 purchase should have triggered U.S. sanctions, according to the new federal law that bars substantial military purchases from Russia. Yet President Trump again defended his Turkish counterpart on Tuesday, refusing to criticize Turkey for the S-400 deal or commit to sanctions, and suggesting Turkey deserved the F-35 stealth fighters it had promised to buy. What's going on here? Why is Trump almost siding with Putin here?
Well, that's an interesting question, and nobody really knows the answer. I think Trump believes that he can work directly one-on-one with Tayyip Erdogan, and there is a deal to be had with the Turks that underlined his decision to pull out from northeast Syria, or partially pull out, given that a small U.S. contingent is still in place, defying pretty much everyone else in Washington, including the administration, but also, importantly, Congress. What I see lately is that even some hawkish senators, and I have Lindsey Graham in mind in particular, are coming closer to the front line that Turkey needs to be given some wiggle room and probably they can work out a deal. What's really surprising to me, along to many other experts, is that the strategy Ankara embarked upon put all your eggs in one basket, that is worked through Trump, is paying off, because the received wisdom for a long time was that there will be blowback because you could alienate Pentagon and Congress. But lo and behold, here we are, and it's working for Erdogan. He's getting pretty much everything. I don't know if that's sustainable and there'll be a price to pay sometime down the line, but so far so good for the Turks. They're getting away with it.
With its annexation of Crimea in 2014 and entry into the Syrian civil war the next year, Russia has significantly increased its presence and combat capabilities in the Black Sea and in the Eastern Mediterranean. NATO has sought to respond to this by boosting Black Sea security. One analyst has argued in the past few days that Turkey might show its commitment to the alliance by playing a key role there, increasing its own Black Sea presence and limiting Russia's presence there via its control of the Bosphorus Strait. What are your thoughts on that? Is that a viable policy?
Up to a point. I mean, first of all, let's say that despite all the acrimony, NATO is an asset for Turkey because it allows it to balance against the Russians. Of course, we are forgiven to get carried away with this Putin-Erdogan double act and speculate that Turkey is coming into Russia's fold. But the raw facts are that Turkey is being encircled by Russian military presence in Syria, in Crimea, which has become, in Putin's own words, a fortress thanks to militarization. But also, let's not forget Armenia, where you have a Russian base. So if you sit in Ankara, you see yourself surrounded by Russian deployments. Now, NATO is good news for Turkey because it allows it to even the playing field without sticking your neck out, right? Because ultimately, it's a multilateral organization. It's not Turkish policy to challenge directly head on the Russians, but you can rely on this insurance policy that is the Article 5 commitment. And that's not to be missed despite all the rhetoric and the outward appearance of a rapprochement. And the Putin-Erdogan chemistry that's been going on. NATO continues to be very relevant to the Turks. In the Black Sea, Turkey is the only naval power that can match the Russians up to a degree. NATO cannot establish full presence because of the limitations of the Black Sea legal regime, going back to the 1930s with the Montreal Convention. The problem with Turkey, which is, of course, undergoing also military modernization, is that its navy is overstretched. It's not just in the Black Sea, but also in the Aegean and in the Eastern Mediterranean, which, as we know, has become an arena of disputes and tensions escalating with the Greeks, but also the Israelis and the Egyptians and the rest of this mini alliance that is forming against Turkey. So Turkey has to juggle lots of conflicts, and despite its naval capabilities, it's on the back foot vis-a-vis Russia. And Turkish strategy, and that's for a long time, it goes back to the 2000s. Some of the listeners would surely remember how Turkey behaved during the 2008 Georgia crisis, when it tried to accommodate the Russians and to keep the U.S. At arm's length from the Black Sea, out of fear that if the push came to shove, Turkey will be left alone facing the Russians, and there will be no American or allied support. And now the same calculation is true now. Facing Russia, Turkey has to find a way to soft balance it, to engage, but also to have other options. But certainly confrontation is not in the cards. In fact, we saw how it plays out, because in Syria we had this crisis in 2015-2016, and ultimately Turkey was wrong-footed and Russia came on top. And this is a lesson learned by Erdogan and Turkish policymakers, that you cannot challenge Russia, you have to work with them, or you want to balance them, but in a more intelligent, more indirect way.
You mentioned working with Russia. Turkey's proposal to build an Istanbul Canal to connect the Black Sea and the Sea of Marmara is reportedly drawing interest from Russian investors, likely because the canal would allow ships to sail between the Mediterranean and Black Sea without passing through the Turkish Straits and thus avoiding the restrictions of Montreux, as you mentioned. Have you heard anything about this Russian interest? Set aside the issue of whether the canal will even be built or not.
I'm not sure Russia will be as forthcoming. First of all, it's a very challenging project, and Russia is not flush with cash, and there are not many Russian investors, apart from the state, or willing to chip in. But if Turkey approaches you, you cannot just turn them down. Out of courtesy, you have to say yes, of course, but let's look at the small print. Let's talk about the specifics. So I think, without knowing much about the inside discussion, that's my gut feeling how it plays out. Just as a caveat, the Black Sea is not as important for Russia in terms of commercial traffic as it used to be in the past. The port of Novorossiysk used to be a major export destination for raw petrol coming out from Russia, but more and more petrol is being exported from other terminals, notably on the Baltic. So it's not such an overwhelming priority, although it would be nice if Russian commercial traffic in particular, but also maybe military ships heading to the East Mediterranean have an alternative beyond beyond the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, the Straits. But there's another caveat that ultimately the Montreal Convention is about countries from outside the Black Sea region coming into the Black Sea. So there are not many restrictions when it comes, or any restrictions when it comes to countries that are on the Black Sea and being interested in sending out their navy or commercial ships. It's just the bottleneck that is the Bosphorus that might be an issue. But again, I mean, the economics of the project are anything but clear, as you rightly said.
Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, an advisor to President Erdogan suggested Turkey might use the threat of the YPG on its border with Syria to invoke NATO's Article 5, which calls all members to defend the security of a fellow member under attack. Could this work?
I'm really doubtful that will work. I think it's just Erdogan pushing up the ante. I think what he's saying is the following. You guys have proclaimed the PKK a terrorist organization, and this artificial distinction between YPG, PYD, and the PKK doesn't hold. You have to go 100% and declare those other offshoots terrorists as well. It's a bargaining tactic. Whether he gets it, I'm not sure. And let's not forget Article 5. That's the nuclear option, metaphorically speaking, of course. It's been invoked only once after 9/11. But I don't think, for what it's worth, the threat posed by the YPG merits such a move. So there won't be any appetite to accommodate the Turks on this one. But then again, there are other mechanisms in the Atlantic Charter. There are security consultations under Article 4 that might be put in motion. So there is some wiggle room which would allow to other policymakers to give something to Turkey, and then Erdogan can come back to Ankara and say he won a concession. So that's how international diplomacy works, and maybe there'll be a bargain down the road. But I don't expect a radical move on the part of everybody else, that they'll just put some strong language, reference Article 5, even proclaim the YPG a terrorist organization. They'll give something to the Turks, but it won't be as much as Erdogan wants them to.
Speaking in Sochi this week, Putin said NATO expansion posed a threat to Russia, yet he added that Russia remained ready to cooperate with the military alliance. On Tuesday, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said NATO is the most successful alliance in history because we have been able to change when the world is changing. That made me wonder what sort of change he might have in mind for today, aligning with Russia, labeling the YPG a terror group, something else?
Well, change is happening at multiple levels. First of all, NATO has this soul searching period. You remember during the operation in Afghanistan, certainly, NATO moved from being this defensive alliance, its core mission inherited from the Cold War, into being a platform for cooperation in so-called out of area interventions. So that was one move in NATO. And now after Crimea, it kind of fell back on his old mission, containing Russia, in other words. But now there's the realization that NATO has to work on multiple threats. It's not just the Russians. There's the issue of terrorism. Many member states are concerned about challenges coming from the south, and also cyber warfare and those hybrid threats are becoming prominent. And it's not just Russia in this game, but other spoilers, other rogue powers and actors. So there's a lot on NATO's agenda, and this adaptation is going on. And of course, NATO is enlarging, bringing other members. The big news now is that North Macedonia is on the cusp of joining NATO. So as NATO is developing, Turkey is trying to mold it in its own image and trying to use NATO as a tool. And the good news is that Turkey is not leaving NATO, despite all calls to the contrary. It's staying in NATO, partly because it's useful for its own, the way it sees its interests. The bad news is that all talks about NATO as a community of values, of democracies, of liberal principles, doesn't match the facts anymore. Certainly, from the Turkish perspective, it's a transactional relationship based on partial overlap of interests. And Turkey uses NATO when it suits, but also is prepared to work with NATO's adversaries, i.e. Russia, on other occasions, and wants to have all options open and have to have flexibility. I think that's the big picture.
Yeah, speaking of that, Western analysts and policymakers have long wondered whether Turkey's descent into authoritarianism under Erdogan would lead to a strategic realignment away from the U.S. and away from NATO and presumably toward Russia. Most argue that this has now happened, as Turkey seems to regularly favor Russia in foreign policy decisions, such as in Syria and with the S-400s. Would you agree, are Russia and Turkey today actual allies?
I wouldn't say allies. In the book I wrote on Russia's policy in Southeast Europe and Eastern Mediterranean, I called it a marriage of convenience. And that was several years ago. Maybe now we are a bit more advanced. But being an ally is much more profound. And let's not forget, those two find themselves a lot in many regional settings. I can think of two fresh examples. One is the TANAP pipeline. So Turkey has worked consistently to diversify energy supplies and to open the southern gas corridors and bring Caspian gas to consumers in Europe in order to enhance its own status and energy security. So that's not necessarily in line with Russian interests. In other words, Turkey is working against Russia, maybe on an issue that is not a top priority, but it's an important subject nonetheless.
But it's also, Russia. It's also working with Russia on the Turkstream pipeline.
Exactly. So it's again balancing act, working on projects with Russia, but also balancing against Russia. And it's been the case for a long time because the Southern Gas Corridor has an oil component as well, the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. So it's the same old story of working, but also competing with the Russians in Eurasia. The other example would be this new Libya-Turkey deal in the Eastern Mediterranean, the delimitation. Now, Turkey is working with the UN-recognized government in Tripoli, whereas Russia and as other powers are supportive of General Haftar in eastern Libya. So they find themselves at odds in this conflict. But one dynamic that has been at play for a long time between Turkey and Russia is that you could work together on issues of common interests and then agree to disagree on other issues. So that's why it's not really an alliance, because it's a mixture of competition but also cooperation. And Turkey has its reasons to work with Moscow, but also to fear the Russians. Ultimately, Turkey, and it's a bit of a philosophical discussion, but it's an important point to be made anyhow. Turkey has this lone wolf instinct. It's beholden only to its own interests and thinks that Russia might be an ally on certain matters, but you don't want to associate yourself fully with the Russians because it might backfire. It just happened so in Syria that Russia became so indispensable that Turkey had to shift its policy and come closer to Putin and try to work with him rather than fight back.
You mentioned how Russia and Turkey are supporting opposing sides in Libya. An article in the UK's independent newspaper on Tuesday said that Putin has been playing both sides, waiting out the war's end, and suggested Turkey and Russia might again form a sort of partnership as they have in Syria. Have you heard anything about that?
I won't be surprised. One thing about Russian policy in the Middle East is flexibility. Key tenets is that you work with all parties. I mean, think about it. Is there another player who is able to be friends with both Israel and the Iranians, with the Kurds, but also Turkey, and with the Saudis and Tehran? So Russia keeps all doors open. It can shift its policy, partly because it's not really embedded in the region. It is an external power. Its interests are not as far-reaching, so you could pull out or strategically return whatever suits you and be opportunistic. So this flexibility is a great asset for the Russians, and they can easily shift their positions. I mean, the stakes for Putin or for Russia as a state are not as high. It's not as if you're fighting the war in Ukraine or North Caucasus. It's far away from home. And that's what works in your favor, that you could make U-turns pretty easily, especially in places like Libya.
You mentioned last week Turkey reached an agreement with Libya on their maritime borders, which Greek and Cypriot officials say encroaches on their territorial waters in the eastern Mediterranean. An analyst I spoke to earlier today said that this issue, Cyprus and the eastern Mediterranean, is the red line for Europe, not Syria or the YPG or what have you, and that any further escalation on the part of Turkey could lead to a total breakdown in Turkey-European relations. I wonder if you agree with that, and also how you see this playing out in the eastern Mediterranean, and also whether Russia has a role.
I mean, these are really important questions. My instinct about Europe and Turkey is that, I mean, yes, there will be a crisis, but we've been through so many crises, and what's remarkable to my mind is how resilient is the relationship. So if you compare that with US-Turkey relations, I think the ties to Europe are much more durable. So you can envision a scenario where there's a complete breakup with the US. But I don't see such thing happening with the EU because of economic interdependence. The very fact that many Turks live in key states as Germany. So there's a human connection as well. And lately, the migration crisis, the so-called migration crisis in 2015-2016, underlined the convergence of interests. So it's a very dense relationship going much beyond those security issues. And for the parties in the relationship might be happy about one another, but I don't think there is a way out. So the incentive for politicians is to find some sort of, to muddle through, to find a formula how you manage those tensions. Is Russia able to mediate in those disputes? I'm not sure, because I mean, Russia cannot be the troubleshooter. I mean, it's not the U.S., a new hegemon in the region, to knock heads together and divide the pie. I think they'll try to adapt, try to profit, exploit the situation, act very opportunistically and short term, but resolving issues will be difficult. I mean, in case, and it's very speculative, but if Cypriots, if Cyprus reunifies, if there is a positive dynamic play, I think Russia will lose, and that's the opinion of many Cyprus watchers, because who will be a guarantor for the security of the island in case it comes together, the two parts? It will be NATO. So Cyprus won't be neutral country anymore, which has been the case since the very start in 1960. It will be joining NATO. So NATO will expand in the Eastern Med, adding to its presence nowadays because of the British military bases on the island. So that will be a net loss for Russia. I think the status quo is beneficial for them, and they'll profit from it. On the question whether it could escalate beyond control, I don't know. I mean, it's been simmering for such a long time, and Turkey has been playing brinkmanship. But so far so good. It hasn't gone over the brink. That might be not sustainable, and we don't know how it will play out. That we might be facing a crisis down the road. But I hope that ultimately Erdogan will be stepping back, because, again, he needs the Europeans. The Europeans need him. The money coming for the refugees is an important benefit for Turkey. Also, the volatile financial situation in Turkey underscores how important is the connection to the EU. So there won't be a big breakthrough vis-a-vis Europe, but hopefully not a divorce either.
So apparently Jens Stoltenberg just announced that Turkey relented in its blockage of the Baltics and Poland defense plan, NATO's Baltics and Poland defense plan. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what NATO might have offered Erdogan in order to give in on this issue.
I guess some language against terrorism. Because, I mean, everybody knew, even the Ukrainians said it openly, that it's a bargaining tactic. It's the opening bid. You're trying to say no on a matter of high priority for other member states in order to get back some concessions. I mean, there's certainly a bargain. Again, I have to see what comes out of those talks, because right now, as we speak, they're having the leaders meeting. Probably it will be some symbolic concessions and maybe some substantive concessions as well. But yeah, I wouldn't expect that the rest of NATO will go as far enough to declare the YPG as a problem. Because, I mean, let's face it, the war against ISIS, despite all assertions to the contrary, is not over. A resurgence is very likely, maybe not the territorial caliphate in western Iraq and eastern Syria, but a terrorist campaign by all those jihadi groups. They've been very flexible over the years. If that happens, and that's a big challenge to the West, and something that many member states of NATO take very seriously, much more serious. If you ask Macron, for instance, that will be his number one concern. It won't be Russia. It will be terrorism coming out from the Middle East and not Africa. If that happens, the relevance of local allies on the ground will be much, much higher. So why close all doors to the YPG and the Kurds when tomorrow they might be needed again in a new episode in this fight against radicals in this part of the world?
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add that I maybe didn't mention or ask?
Well, again, I mean, the Russian-Turkish relationship is really interesting. And Putin is coming to Istanbul in January to inaugurate Turk Stream. But we shouldn't be forgetting that Turkey is working with Russia, again, at the risk of repeating myself. But last year, the Turkish purchase of Russian gas went dramatically down, partly because of the cheaper liquefied natural gas, including from the US, that is on the market. So Turkey is trying to diversify and to wean itself out of dependence on Russia. And for the Russians, Turkey is an important country. It's a transit, now a Turkstream, a transit country, but also as a major market. It's the number two market after Germany for natural gas. Maybe it will be overshadowed by China one day, but still, it's a customer you rather want to be with you than lose. But yeah, it's a complex bargaining process where each of the parties is trying to shape the relationship in its interest. So it's not driven by love for one another, but very cold-hearted calculation.
This analyst I spoke to earlier today said this: the idea that Russia would take any risks to save Turkey over any issue is a deeply misguided point of view. Would you agree with that? Russia would be willing to do nothing, to risk nothing to help Turkey?
Yeah, I don't think Russia is in the business of taking risks. I mean, it has a very pragmatic policy on many of those issues. But so is Turkey. But again, what's happening between US and Turkey, which is entirely of those two countries doing, so it's not Russia's, it's not a result of Russia's policy or any decision taken. The Kremlin is benefiting Russia, because even if Turkey is not decoupling itself from NATO, the outward appearance of a deep rift and the periodic crisis is what serves Russia more than anything, the kind of rift in the alliance, which, let's not forget, I mean, if you look at conventional power, Russia is much inferior to NATO in all kinds of capabilities. So using politics and diplomacy, but also benefiting from other people's crisis, is a very smart strategy. So without moving your finger at the Kremlin, you are accruing all kinds of geopolitical benefits.
Mm-hmm. Dimitar Bechev, research fellow at the Atlantic Council, thanks for your time and insight.
Thank you.